So this evening I want to teach the quite famous sutta called the Simile of the Cloth. It's from the Majjhima Nikaya 7. And it's a sutta that starts at where the practice always has to begin, and gradually, step by step, takes us through the stages that we go through to liberation. So it's an explanation of that process. And I want to start by reading what this has to say. So this is the actual simile of the cloth here, right? Bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine, it would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Bhikkhu, suppose the cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination can be expected. So the simile he's using here is something that everyone in his culture would know about dyeing cloths, because that's how they, I mean, everybody did their own thing. You know, they weaved their own cloth, and this was like a part of the culture. So it was an image that they would understand, and basically saying, if you take a cloth that sort of kind of has dirty and stains on it and you try and dye it, don't be surprised if it doesn't look very good. It doesn't work. You have to, you know, purify, have a pure cloth to start with. And this relates very directly to the idea of purification, which is something that is central to what the Buddha teaches. You know, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's principal teachings on mindfulness, it starts with, this is the direct path for the purification of beings. I mean, he doesn't mess around here. And so, one way we can look at this whole practice that we're talking about and practicing is this is a method of purification. And be careful with this, because some people hear the word purify and, you know, their hackles go straight up, right? And so it's like there's no wagging finger here. And we also have to be very careful not to sort of, you know, go to that place of, oh, you know, I'm just not pure enough to do this practice. I'm not, you know, don't go there. Just don't go there. It's like, purification is a process, just like this practice is a process. And over time, our cloth gets cleaner and cleaner, and then when we dip it into the dye, it comes out pure. It's just the nature of the practice, and the nature of being a human being, for that matter. Otherwise, you could just turn this whole practice into like this really sophisticated way to sort of beat yourself up, which doesn't do anybody any good, right? The Buddha goes on. What bhikkhus are the imperfections that defile the mind? Covetous and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind. So he's being, here's a big long list. Here's the things you have to watch for, right? And I'm sure you can all understand what he's talking about here. Then he goes on to say, knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, the bhikkhu abandons it. Abandons it. Right? So before we go any further there, I want to read you something. This is from Joseph Goldstein, and he's actually using this same simile of the cloth. And he's talking about how we have to work skillfully when we see that we're being somewhat less than pure, which we all do. I mean, we're all human beings. We all do things that we go, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. I wish I hadn't said that. Right? The first thing you might remind yourself in times of difficulty is the fact that you have accumulated great powers of purity and liberation in your mind. Which is true. If you're just the fact that you've chosen to do this practice, just that in and of itself points to something quite powerful. The truth may be hard to remember or to believe in the midst of some mental storm of fear, anger, intense craving, or whatever, but it is true. Otherwise, you would not be here as a human being. And the fact that you've been drawn to practice the path of awakening indicates even stronger forces of purity within us. His Holiness Dzogchen Khenpo Rinpoche, one of the great Tibetan masters of this century, wrote, "Ask yourself how many of the billions of inhabitants on this planet have any idea how rare it is to have been born as a human being? How many of those who understand the rarity of human birth ever think of using the chance to practice the Dhamma? How many of those who start continue? Reflecting in this way on our own interest in the Dhamma generates feelings of joy and confidence." This is the opposite of beating yourself up. And he's just reminding us that it's so important that we see this and that we have gratitude for this. You know, that we've encountered the Dhamma, that we've chosen to look, to practice it, to wake up more. We can start over time, over years of practice, start to see the changes in our heart and mind. Aren't we lucky? You know, aren't we lucky? And we should have gratitude for this, right? And then there's the word abandoning. He says, you know, like that verse I read, you know, knowing that covetous and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. So the word abandon, if you look this up in the dictionary, to leave completely and finally, forsake utterly, desert, or to give up, discontinue, withdraw from. So this is like, not like, well, you know, I'll just do this sometime, but not all the time. It's not casual in any way. Abandoning is like, enough already, I'm not going to go there anymore. As best I can, that's what I'm going to do. Understanding that, of course, you're going to fail sometimes in this resolve. But it's like, we're setting up the conditions where we consciously choose not to, you know, to form that, make that our practice, right? But the tricky part is, we have to, before we can abandon something, we have to see that it's there in the first place. If we don't see it, how can we possibly abandon it? If we don't realize what it is, how can we abandon it? This is what the practice of mindfulness gives us. Mindfulness is the practice of seeing these things as they arise and going, ah, I can see that this doesn't lead me towards more wholesomeness, it leads me away from it. It doesn't lead me towards more happiness or the happiness of others, it leads away from that. And this is what mindfulness allows us to do. And so this is like We're forming the intention. And here's the first two steps on the Eightfold Path. The first step on the Eightfold Path says, you understand that these things are unwholesome. Do you understand that if you do this, it's going to be a distraction from your practice. Your mind isn't going to go still. And then you set the intention to, okay, then I'm going to abandon them. This is the intention you set. This is the beginning of the path, the first two steps. Right? Then, and there's a whole bunch of language here about other things, abandoning them, and he goes on and on, listing all the impurities and making sure we know them all and abandon them. I'm not going to read you all of that. But we see that the beginning of this practice is all about right understanding and right intention. That's where it has to begin. That's why those are the first two steps on the Eightfold Path. But then he says, the interesting thing. And he acquires unwavering confidence in the Dhamma. Thus, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. He acquires unwavering confidence in the Sangha. The Sangha is the Blessed One's disciples, is practicing good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. That is, the disciples are worthy. Right? And then he goes on and says, he also says that he's blessed and is accompanied fully enlightened in perfect true knowledge, the conduct sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons, to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. This is he's describing the Buddha. So what he's really saying here, what he's describing, is the three refuges. Where we started this evening, when we chanted the three refuges. It's like, once you've set intention, once you have clear right understanding and you set intention, then you take refuge. Because refuge is the protection. Refuge encourages you to continue to follow your intention. That's what refuge is for. It gives us it's a strengthener that allows us to see this. And so what he's saying is, basically, once you've started to clear out the impurities, then you're naturally drawn to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. It's like, what comes next? And it's something that we sort of often don't pay much attention to. I like to chant the refuges before I teach because it reminds me. Oh, this is important. But it becomes sort of, if we're not careful, this sort of pro forma rote performance. It isn't, and we don't think about the meaning of this so much anymore. And so I want to talk some about that, because that's what he's saying is that's what comes next. So what does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha? What does that actually mean? By the Buddha, we can mean several things. If you were culturally Buddhist, if you grew up in a Buddhist family, you'd have a certain idea of it. There's that thing on the altar in the kitchen, and And you know, there's the traditions and rituals that we perform as a family. And so, in that case, you might even think of, you know, that the actual person of the Buddha might, even though he lived 2,500 years ago, might be significant to you because it's sort of in your blood. But if, like the most of us here in the West, we came to Buddhist practice later in life, we don't have that cultural connection. So, what does it mean? How can we think about how can we think about taking refuge in the Buddha? And I think the best way to do that, there are two ways. One is just to think about the fact that this person lived 2,600 years ago now and became enlightened. And what's incredible to me is his teachings are still being taught today. That whatever he achieved and taught has lasted all that time. Which sort of points in my mind that, gee, there might be something worthwhile here. That might be something useful here. And the other thing, and for me, the main way I take refuge in the Buddha is the Buddha said over and over again that we all have bodhicitta, Buddha nature, that we're all Buddhas in the making, potential Buddhas. And so, yeah, I can identify with that. I can identify with that potential in me. But the interesting thing about all of that, all of these different possibilities, is they require faith. We never met the Buddha. We never were around when he was around. All we have is these books, these texts that have been translated into English, lucky for us, that say this is what the Buddha taught. This is an act of faith. And this is where faith comes into the Buddhist practice, right at the very beginning of the taking refuge. We have to have faith that this makes sense, that yes, this is true. Otherwise, we never connect. We never take refuge in the Buddha. So, this is another interesting thing in this sutta here. This is after the Buddha. This is a sutta called the Noble Search, and it's describing the process the Buddha went through before he became an enlightened being, and right at the time he became an enlightened being, and what was going on. I find this interesting. And so here's the Buddha. He's become enlightened. He knows he's enlightened. He actually says, "My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there's no renewal of being." Like he's enlightened. "I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. It is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me." So he's basically saying, why would I bother teaching? No one's going to understand what I have to say anyway. He's become enlightened, and now he's like, now what do I do? Oh, well, teaching doesn't make any sense. No one will understand what I'm saying. Then, of course, then the Brahma Sahamapati knew with his mind the thoughts in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, inclines to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. So this is a cultural thing again. And whether, I mean, an actual Brahma, a divine being, thought this, or this is what the experience the Buddha was having felt like, describing something, don't worry about, don't have to believe in Brahmas, is what I'm saying, I suppose. Then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm, or flex his extended arm, the Brahma Sahampati vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on one shoulder, and extending his hands in reverential salutation towards me, said, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. Beings with little dust in their eyes. They can't quite see clearly. There will be those who understand the Dhamma. Then I listened to the Brahman's pleading, and out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes, and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach. So he's saying, yeah, there's all kinds of people out there, but at time he decides to actually teach. Lucky us. And this is how we started. And I love this phrase, and I'm going to come back to it. There are those who have little dust in their eyes. It's like they sort of can see, but it's fuzzy. This is us, hopefully. Maybe we're the ones with little dust in our eyes, that we're open to hearing these teachings and hopefully purifying our faces, in a sense, getting rid of the dust in our eyes. I like to think of that as a possibility, at least. So it's like, taking refuge in the Buddha is an act of faith, that this is all true. You know, whether, you know, the imagery is, you know, from a culture of 2,600 years ago in North India. So whether a great Brahma came down from the heavens, essentially, and convinced the Buddha, or this is, you know, the experience he had, you know, maybe it was sort of like a psychedelic trip, who knows. But it's like he had this sort of image, this experience, this divine awakening, that, yes, this is something I should do. Then there's taking refuge in the Dhamma, which is the second of the refuges, right? Which means, basically, meaning is the teachings of the Buddha, the record of all the things that have come down through the ages after him teaching for 40 years. This is a huge, huge body of knowledge that teaches an incredible variety of different ways that you could purify yourself, essentially. Different methods, different roads you can take. It's sort of like, I like to think of the Dhamma as like this elaborate roadmap. It's my old Boy Scout energy. I love maps because I was a Boy Scout, right? But it's like, you know, you can follow this route or you can follow that route. But it's no sense just looking at the map. If you just look at the map, it's like, oh, nice map. Nothing's going to happen here. You actually have to do something. So taking refuge in the Dhamma takes effort. We need to study, immerse ourselves in the teaching. And so taking refuge in the Dhamma, we have to sort of form the intention to dig into what the Buddha said. Whether it's Like me, I love reading the actual sutras and stuff like that. But it might be just listening to Dharma talks or reading books by people who have studied the Dhamma and written commentary on the Dhamma. There's lots of different ways to do this. I'm not saying you all have to become Dhamma scholars, but it's important that we all study. At some level, we have to look into what the Buddha said and absorb it in this way. And this takes effort. Then there's the Sangha, the third, taking refuge in the Sangha. And traditionally, the Sangha was all meant those who over the last 2,600 years have reached enlightenment. It's a big list. I mean, in the sutta itself, there's hundreds of people where someone comes to the Buddha and gets teaching, and they wake up and within, sometimes right away, sometimes over time, people become enlightened. There's this interesting thing again in the sutta here, where the Buddha has figured out, I used to hang out in the forest with those five guys, which he did for like 5 or 6 years. He hang out and lived this very, very austere life. And so he decides, I know where they're going to be. It's just that time of year. They'll be in that forest there. So he starts to walk and gets to where they are. And the funny thing is, when they first see him coming, he's left their practice. They were like really austere and thin and emaciated, and they were just trying to make themselves suffer as much as they could because they figured that's how they'd understand suffering. And he'd sort of become fairly, really healthy and robust and eaten, and there's stories about that. But and so when they first saw him, they were like, "Oh, it's that backslider, Gotama. Here he's coming. Look, he looks so. Look at the flesh on his cheeks. Boo hiss." They really sort of razzed him. But as he got closer, they realized he sort of like shone, and they were like, "What's happened? What's going on? Who are you?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm the one who's no longer suffers, and then I've come to teach." And they were all like, "Oh my God, this is incredible!" And he sat down and he taught them the Four Noble Truths. That was the first time he ever taught the Four Noble Truths. But then here's the interesting thing in the sutta. "Then the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, attained the unborn supreme security from bondage." The Buddha came and taught these people with just a little dust in their eyes, and his teaching was so powerful, they became enlightened. The sutta is full of stories like this. This is just the first of like many, many, many stories where people connect to the Buddha. And that's how the Sangha arose. The Sangha has other meanings as well besides those who became enlightened. Basically, and the one I feel most comfortable with is all those people who I'm practicing with right now. Right now, we consciously co-created a Sangha, and we came here tonight to share the Dhamma. This is a Sangha right here, right now. It can also mean like the people I practice with on a regular basis. Some people like to go to the Saturday morning Sangha or come to this group here or whatever on a regular basis, and you sort of get to know people, even if it's just like in the most casual way. And Sangha is so powerful. The energy of people you practice with is such a powerful thing. I can remember, sitting long retreats. There'll be like 90 or 100 people in the hall, and I'm sitting, and there'll be someone sitting in front of me, and all I ever saw for like a month, the only thing I ever saw about this person was the back of their head. That's all I knew. Oh, the back of the head looks like that. Or maybe, well, they like that shawl they always wear, you know. So, but it's like the most, but the energy and connection you feel to these people, even though you don't know their names, you know nothing about them, is so powerful. Because they're there practicing just like you. And we, in Sangha, when we practice together, we lift each other up, literally. We support each other. And so that's another meaning of the, you know, taking refuge in the Sangha. And so taking refuge in the Sangha is at the heart level. And so when we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, we're letting in, letting go into feelings of safety. I mean, refuge is a place where we feel safe, right? And protection that arises out of faith, effort, and love. All three of these things are like what supports the practice. This refuge is based on those three things: having faith, putting in effort to understand, and then opening your heart. And it's really interesting if you look. What happens when there's some sort of religious or spiritual organization where only two of those things are present instead of all three? This is a really interesting thing. You know, I looked at this. So if we have faith and we make effort to study the teachings, but we aren't grounded in love for all beings, then very easily we veer towards fundamentalism, fanaticism, extremism. We know we're right because our faith is strong, and the holy book we study, you know, could be the Pali Canon, could be the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, it makes no difference. It tells us we are right. We can quote it chapter and verse because we've really studied, we put a lot of effort into studying. But now we've just lost any sense of the heart, the connection to other beings. Without that, all that energy and practice, we see this in what happens in the fanatics of any stripe, in the religious sense, cause so much harm and suffering in the world. Some of the hugest, biggest wars in the world were fought over nothing more than, you know, my faith is right and your faith is wrong, therefore it's okay for me to do whatever I want with you. Total nonsense. But that's what that energy, if it that isn't there. If we have faith and love, but we make no effort to understand the teachings, then we easily sort of drift off into what I'll call the excesses of the flower children. Speaking from personal experience, you know, it's like, oh, I love everyone. Everything's love all the time. I just love everything. You know, putting flowers up, whatever. And then, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that, except that it's not grounded. It drifts off into, you know, the excesses of that age. You know, I think of the hippie age when I was, you know, we got pretty stupid and crazy, you know, in a lot of ways. There was some beautiful things and some things that were somewhat less so, shall we say, because we weren't grounded in reality in any sense of the word. And if we have knowledge and love but no faith, like we study, but we're not connected to anything, then we fall prey to what Trungpa Rinpoche called spiritual materialism. You know, faith anchors us in a particular tradition, a form of practice. Without faith, it's easy to adopt a smorgasbord approach to practice. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. It doesn't work. because the practice, no matter what form you take, if you have to sort of dig deeply into that particular form. You know, there's a famous saying that he says, you know, if you want water, you don't dig 10 1-foot holes, you dig 1 10-foot hole. You have to dig deep into this practice. You have to sort of stay, you know. And I'm not saying this is the only way, the only practice. There are lots of forms of Buddhism for that matter. But you have to find something that works for you, that resonates for you, that connects it to, with you, you at the heart level, and then go deep. Really dig deep into it. Then I'll go back to the original sutta here. He considers thus, the imperfections of the mind have in part been given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished by me. And he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. The key word is there, in part, being given up. Yeah, we have right clear understanding, we've formed intention, we've taken refuge. But that's not enough. It's the beginning. There's more to it than that. And then, this verse. Bhikkhus, if a bhikkhu of such virtue, such a state of concentration and such wisdom, eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice with various sauces and curries, even that will be no obstacle for him. In other words, even if someone, you know, because they went on an alms round and whatever people gave them, it would be, that's what they ate. And if they, if someone gave him this really, really luxurious food, which often people would crave, right, because they had reached this level of purity, it wouldn't make any difference. They'd just eat it like they got nothing but a bowl of rice. Just pointing to it. And then he says something really interesting. He abides pervading one quarter with the mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all and to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. And repeats this for the next, the other three Brahma Viharas, which is the next point. So now he's saying, okay, now you've got your mind clear. Now you see where you're going, you're heading in the right direction, you've taken refuge. Now open your heart. That's what comes next. It's the heart that comes next. It's like, can you really let yourself feel the beauty, experience the beauty, express the beauty of loving kindness for all beings? Notice what it says here, you know, all around and everywhere, and to all as to himself. Don't forget yourself. He provides the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. So your mind is now filled, heart mind is filled with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable. In other words, unimaginable. So that's what comes next. Now that we're practicing, and you're practicing mindfulness, and we're going in the right direction, and we've taken refuge, then we open our hearts. That's what has to come next. Because if we don't connect at the heart level with everyone around us, with everyone in the Sangha, with everything in the world, we're still stuck in places of ill will. You know, we can't have thoughts of loving kindness for everyone except those people, which is what happens. You know, we judge certain people as not worthy of my loving kindness thoughts. We can't do that. We have to, that's what has to happen next. We have to open our hearts wide. Not easy. For 1 second, saying this is easy. And so this is the Buddha describing essentially, you know, how to live in the world. We have to live in the world with a heart full of loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity. This is why, you know, the middle steps of the Eightfold Path all have to do with how we act in the world. You know, yes, we have to be mindful, and yes, we have to, you know, do our practice, and yes, then we have to open our hearts and take in and have thoughts of loving kindness towards everyone, without exception. And that affects how we act and how we speak, what kind of work we do, everything. And this takes even more effort. Whoops. And so here we start, and so the Buddha is also talking about right effort here. He's talking about the fact that we have to put in effort over and over and over again. We can't sort of be sort of wishy-washy. Well, this, you know, I can open my heart a little bit sometimes, but you know, I really just want to sit and meditate. Be this calm, still Buddha-like person. Yes, but without the heart, it's incomplete. Then he goes on and says, this is the next verse. He understands thus, there is this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and beyond there is an escape from this whole field of perception. So he's saying, he's pointing to, the word inferior I don't like, but it's like it's the word that was used in the translation. What he's pointing to is that we also have to understand that what we're talking about here is or what I've been blabbing about for the last half hour, is what's called absolute reality. You know, this is where we want to end up and understanding and knowing that at some point, actually experiencing the absolute reality of the truth of what the Buddha is teaching. But we also have to understand that we live in the world of relative reality. Day-to-day stuff. You know, we got to go to the store and get groceries. And we have to then cook those groceries. And we got to clean the kitchen and blah, 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 stuff. And that's this day-to-day life. And we have to understand that we somehow live in both those worlds simultaneously. It took me a long time to get to the point where I could sort of imagine this, let alone, you know, try and actually do it. But we have to sort of understand we live in the world of relative reality, of me, not me. And at the same time, we can understand and experience the me, not me, falling away, where there's just one, nothing. You know, whether there's everything or nothing, you know, you get into Buddhist philosophy in various ways. But it's like, that's where this leads, and we have to understand that we both have to live in the relative world of relative reality and purify ourselves in that relative reality as best we can, how we live. And understand that ultimately we experience everything through the world of absolute reality. That's where we're headed. Then he says, when he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. So at some point, now way out of my knowledge, experience anyway. At some point, you mindfully see that liberation has actually occurred. It's actually an experience that you have. So they tell me. Okay, but here, once again, it's important to realize that we might have like a little tiny taste of that as we practice every day. Have this like, that little space where for like 3 breaths, everything is just so calm and so still. And we just go, oh, that's what liberation feels like, only it's going to be like that all the time. Mind-boggling to me, but that's what it says. So we it's not like an on-off switch, is what I'm saying. It's like this is a very gradual, progressive process, step by step by step. Then he's been teaching this all to this Brahmin, and now on that occasion, the Brahmin was sitting not far from the Blessed One. Then he said to the Blessed One, "But does Master Gotama go to the Bahuka River to bathe? In other words, do you go to this holy river to bathe and wash away your sins?" Which was the common belief within that culture, that there were places you could go to, and if you bathed in that place, all of your past action, unwholesome actions were washed away just in the bathing itself. This is the Buddhist answer. "Why, Brahman, go to the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do?" "Master Gotama, the Bahuka River is held by many to give liberation. It's held by many to give merit, and many wash away their evil actions." Then the Buddha addressed, and he basically says, no, the actual bathing is totally internal, has nothing to do with the river. It's the bathing in the teachings, bathing in the knowledge, bathing in, that's what we have to bathe in. So he said, "What can the Chandrika bring to pass? What the Payaga, what the Baku," these are all famous rivers, and "they cannot purify an evildoer, a man who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure heart has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day. One fair in act, one pure in heart, brings his virtue to perfection. It is here, Brahman, that once you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is not offered, with faith and free from avarice, what need you to go to Gaia, to these places?" It's like it's all about what's inside, not the external show. I don't want to sort of repeat something here. Oh, by the way, I did actually, when I was in India back in 87, I went to the source of the Ganges, which is a very holy place up in the way, way up in the mountains. It's a glacier, and the river is rushing out of this glacier. The water's really cold. And I bathed there, because that was what you're supposed to do. I'm still far from pure. So. But it was an interesting experience, because it was sort of culturally part of the world I was part of at the time. I was studying with someone named Swami Vishnu Devananda. What he recommended, we go to the source and bathe. It was interesting. What can I say? So remember what we're doing here. We're heading towards enlightenment. This is why we practice. Don't get discouraged with that. It feels like nothing's happening. I've been there. It doesn't, the process is what's important. The end point will come when it comes. all about the process. It's all about just doing the practice, doing the practice, doing the practice. And when I say do the practice, I mean in the broadest sense of the word. How you live your life is all practice, as well as the formal sitting practices and listening to the Dharma talks and whatever. It's all about just continually staying in the process and keeping going. That's all I've, if I've learned nothing else over my 47, 48 years of practice of meditation, that's what is more important than anything, just keeping going. At the same time, being wise to go, oh, wait, this isn't working, I need to shift a little bit sometimes. That's also true. We'll finish with this poem by Dana Faulks. It's called Enough, and it, I think, describes what I was just trying to say very clearly. It's enough to offer love, no matter how imperfectly received or given. It's enough to try and fail at a difficult task. Enough to fall and rise, stumble, fall again, sigh, and start to walk, however slowly, in the direction the soul points. It's enough to seek peace and find pain, to gain nothing but a vision of truth, and take the long route home. It's enough to feel temptation, the dance of the senses, the hot pull of desire, enough to call on God, walk through fire, sleep and cry and fear or welcome dying. It's enough to be and breathe, to feel the touch of wind on skin. It's enough to take the day as it comes, to watch the ripples on the lake as the rock sinks to the bottom, to see the wild reflection of the surface calm into a mirror once again. It's enough to hear the voice of fear and hide, or seek it out and face the shame or shadows. It's enough to seek to tame demons and watch them multiply instead. It's enough to be buffeted by the winds of change and not blown over. I and you in all of us, more than enough. That's what we're trying to do here. Be more than enough. Just see that it's so stepwise and progressive. So I'll finish my talking.